but to all the forefathers, demigods, great sages, saintly persons, and everyone else. Householder life is thus beneficial. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. According to the Vedic system, when one is born in this material world, he has many obligations. He has obligations to the demigods of the sun and moon, King Indra, Varuna, etc., because they are supplying the necessities of life. We receive heat, light, water, and all other natural amenities through the mercy of the demigods. We are also indebted to our forefathers who have given us these bodies, paternal property, intelligence, society, friendship, and love. Similarly, we are indebted to the general public for politics and sociology, and we are also indebted to lower animals such as horses, cows, asses, dogs, and cats. In this way, as soon as one is born in this material world as a human being, he has so many obligations and is bound to repay all these obligations. If he does not repay them, he is further entangled in the process of birth and death. The Grihamethi, however, who is overly addicted to material things, does not know that if he simply takes shelter of the lotus feet of Mukunda, he is immediately freed from all obligations to others. Unfortunately, a Grihamethi does not have any interest in Krishna consciousness. Prahlad Maharaj says, Matirna Krishne Paratasvatova Mitho Apipadvyeta Grihavratana. That's Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 5, Text 30. A Grihavrata is the same as a Grihamethi. One who takes sex life to be supreme finds action in Krishna consciousness confusing. Either due to his own personal consideration or due to his having taken instructions from others or conferring with them, he becomes addicted to sexual indulgence and cannot act in Krishna consciousness. Om Jnana Timirantasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Ho Shri Yutaparakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagan Raghunathan Vitamtam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Dadata Shri Vishakhan Vitamamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamani Haripriye Vanchagalpurubhyascha Kripasindhubhya Evachapitadanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namah Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Pitra Devarshi Martyanam Bhutanam Atmanashchaha Kshemyam Vadanti Sharanam Bhaves Minyan Grihashramaha. The woman continued, according to authorities, the householder life is pleasing not only to oneself, but to all the forefathers, demigods, great sages, saintly persons, and everyone else. A householder life is thus beneficial. Why is the householder life pleasing to these these classes of living beings, forefathers, demigods, great sages, saintly persons, and everyone else. What is it about the household or ashram that pleases them?
Because the householder has to be generous, so he's reciprocating. He's not for himself. It's extensive.
This is why ashram system for the Vedanta level.
How so?
Because we're following the rules and regulations and we're following the Dharma. We're trying to avoid it. Pleasing them would be living it through that way, not just living it for sex or like for sexual gratification.
Anything else? Yeah, these are both in writings. In particular, as Prabhupada begins his purport here, according to the Vedic system, when one is born in this material world, he has many obligations. And then Prabhupada details why we should feel grateful. Because even if we don't feel grateful, we still have obligations. even if we don't realize, I mean, the nature of a self-centered person is such that he or she assumes that everything is just ready-made for his enjoyment or for his agenda or program, without considering all the people that have made it possible or all the persons who have made it possible for he or she to perform those activities. Therefore, the Vedic system actually systematizes this gratitude in the form of what we call panchmahayagyas. One has to perform five sacrifices every day. He has to sacrifice to the five classes of living beings that are mentioned here. He has to sacrifice for the forefathers. He has to sacrifice for the demigods, for the sages, for the humanity especially, and for all living beings. So the household life is therefore pleasing because it's really only in the household life that this is enjoying. When one is a brahmachari, he doesn't have that same obligation. As soon as we enter into civic life or social life, and definitely if we are engaged in pravriti marg, that is to say any degree of sense gratification, then the rules and regulations of the Vedic literatures apply to us, and as we've already mentioned, this sort of gratitude that we should feel has been codified. The great misfortune of modern society is that people have given up this dharmic existence, and therefore people are just not even aware that there's anyone that they should feel obligated to. People assume that what they have to eat comes from the local supermarket, even though it's genetically modified, and even though it's, I mean, may not even really be edible, in many cases carcinogenic and polluted in other ways. But, you know, something comes very neatly shrink-wrapped, and you just have to go to the store and pay for it, and it's as if automatic, and there's no one else involved, and therefore I don't have to feel any obligation. So, therefore, Srila Prabhupada is next in this purport. He's describing actually how it is that we have, or should feel at least, some sense of obligation to all these other living beings. He says, we receive heat, light, water, and all other natural amenities through the mercy of the demigods. Now, mercy of the demigods. The demigods themselves are only performing their own karma, so how is it mercy? Why do we say mercy of the demigods?
They're still in service to Krishna.
But there's the spin-off, you can say. We're receiving light from the sun and the moon, so they're serving us.
The fact of the matter is, they don't have to do their dharma. Just like we don't have to do ours. I mean, they do depend on that dharma, but, you know, it's always a voluntary thing if one wants to act in accordance with the tenets of the Shastra. So, generally we don't make mistakes, but sometimes we see that demigods do mess up as well, because that's what it means to be a conditioned soul. Even if you're so highly placed as Indra or Varuna or the moon or so many others that Prabhupada has mentioned here. So they are dedicated with such tremendous commitment and capability as well that we even say that someone is as regular as the sun, that the sun himself becomes the measure of all dedication, because the sun is so predictable. We know exactly at the time that the sun is going to appear every day. And that's only because he's acting in accordance with his dharma, his swadharma. So we receive all the necessities of our lives and all the amenities that we have, just like right now, not right now, most of the time here in Vancouver, it's very cold and wet. So we want to go inside and we have our nice heaters and we take shelter of those and we're all set, without considering necessarily how Agni is involved or how Vayu is involved or how the sun is involved or what it has to do with Soma or anything else. So that's one consideration, what to speak of the food supply. Now that human beings who are imbued with demoniac spirit are very vigorously trying to control the entire food supply of the human population and to exploit the people on the basis of their need to eat, in exactly the same way that, at least in America, they have controlled the one's access to health care when one has disease, because everybody gets diseased in this world. So they've very carefully manipulated that need and exploiting it at the cost of the citizens. So they're trying to do so even with food as well. And we see so many strange things. In fact, Badri Narayan Prabhu sent me an email recently in which there is actually some, I think it was an advertisement for some research that is being funded very enthusiastically among biologists who are in the Western universities, particularly in America. They figured out that they can actually nutrate a human being without food. Now, I know that when I was taking care of my elderly mother, she couldn't eat properly and she had to receive most of her nutrition through a feeding tube that was permanently placed in her stomach. So, you know, I realized at that point that her life depends on this bag of goo that's filled with all sorts of necessary nutrients. So in a similar way, biologists know that you can actually reduce all the nutrients that are required to sustain a human body into little wafers of such chemicals. And they've actually designed a machine that's kind of like, you know, we have a color printer, and you've got different cartridges of different colors of ink in your printer. So you put the different cartridges of nutrients in this food printer, and you can print out little wafers of foodstuffs, and you don't need food anymore. Since they're already, I mean, why involve Mother Nature at all? I mean, they're already genetically modifying everything, so why not just take it all the way and print out little food wafers, and then you can really exploit people, because then they forget how to farm, they even forget what to eat. Think about it. Nowadays, most people cannot grow their own food. They have no idea how to do that. And plus the elements. I have a friend who's a toxicologist in Texas. He told me, both he and his wife are toxicologists. They work for some, I think, oil companies down there. They're always checking the Bay of Houston to see that whether the toxicity levels have exceeded the legal limit. So he told me that there's actually no aquifer in North America that is free from the contamination of industrial effluent and heavy metals like cadmium and arsenic, mercury, etc. What to speak of agricultural runoff and biological pollution, sewage, and other such things. So even the aquifers in North America are so completely polluted that you can't really farm with pure elements there. We know the air is polluted, the water is polluted according to this man. In so many levels, you know, Mother Nature has been tampered with. But the point is, people don't really know how to farm, even if that weren't the case, because they've lost touch with that science through disuse. And what is it that has impelled that disuse or inspired it? Someone came along with the bright idea, or I should say the greedy idea, to make it easier. Usually this is how things are introduced, in case you haven't noticed. Something is introduced for you as a convenience for your own happiness, and then gradually all other options are removed. So that's what's happened now, and so people are virtually dependent on supermarkets and therefore on the trucking industry and on so many others, and they don't realize the whole chain of involved in this process. But if you take it a step further, I mean if you take it to the next logical level, then you don't even need to worry about farming at all, because you can actually print out your little food wafers if you just get the nutrients that are necessary. So some companies probably are very avidly funding this sort of research, and you can expect this to come within the next generation or two or three, in exactly the same way that we were introduced to spy cams every 10 feet in the United States. Now there's this fellow hiding out in the Moscow airport because he leaked some very sensitive information about the U.S. government's massive program to spy on its own citizens, what to speak of governments worldwide. And we'll see how that drama plays out. But the point is here that demigods don't really have to keep on giving us their support. We have a symbiotic relationship with these demigods. And in chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has described in several verses that relationship. He says, for example, in the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu, and blessed them, saying, "Be thou happy by this yajna sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation." We have everything we need, including the facility for liberation, if we just follow the program. But because of lust, anger, and greed, we concoct so many other things instead. We've got better ideas, and this is what's created the hell that we now live in. Krishna continues, Devan bhavayatanena te deva bhavayantavah parasparam bhavayantah shreya paramavapsyatah. The demigods, being pleased by sacrifices, will also please you. And thus, by cooperation between men and demigods, prosperity will reign for all. So Prabhupada's purport there you can read. This is chapter 3, text number 11. The point is that we have a symbiotic relationship with demigods who are controlling material nature in so many ways. And for that reason, it's written into the civic codes, so to speak, of civilized human life. Written down as the Dharma Shastra, that a householder in particular should offer these Panch Mahayajnas to the forefathers, to the demigods, to the sages, to humanity in general, and to all living beings. That's the idea here. Prabhupada is continuing to elaborate on why we should feel indebted, since many of us don't. We're so out of touch with the reality of the situation that we see no reason why we should feel indebted to anyone. But so Prabhupada is very kindly enlightening us here. He says, we are also indebted to our forefathers who have given us these bodies. That's the obvious one, and probably the only one we can think of. Then we've also got paternal property. That makes some sense if you've ever received an inheritance. about intelligence, society, friendship, love? What do our forefathers have to do with that? If we live in a dharmic society, and dharmic society, generally as a rule of thumb, you can say it means a conservative society. If we live in such a society, then we have to respect the fact that we've been given thousands and thousands and thousands of years of cumulative wisdom, culture, scientific attainment, discipline, artistic achievement, so many things we've been given. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada points out where it's most relevant to us, society, friendship, and love. If we live in a stable society, it's because just as the demigods decided to show us mercy by supplying the gross necessities of life, our forefathers decided to show us mercy by maintaining the dharma for us to inherit it. The problem is in Kali Yuga, people have not maintained it. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that a dharmic society is nothing if not conservative, or at least I implied that. How can we say that that's so?
We got there maintaining certain rules. It is conservative.
Maintenance means conservatism.
Yeah.
Sattva guna, the primary characteristic of sattva is that it's able to maintain. And this is, we will note, with importance. This is the function of Lord Vishnu. Shri Shri Radha Madan Mohan Ki Jai. In his Guna Avatar feature, Lord Vishnu's function in universal maintenance is to maintain things. Lord Brahma is able to create things, which is passionate. Shiva is able to destroy things, which is tamasic. But Vishnu alone is the maintainer. Those who would recognize Vishnu's authority, and especially those who would emulate and follow it, they also put a primacy on maintenance. So maintenance means conservatism. What magnitude of conservatism are we talking about? I'm going to give you an example. There is a standard history book, which I read when I was in college, written by a couple of German scholars, about Indian, mainly social and political history, because these are the things that historians mainly concern themselves with. Who ate what where, who slept where and how, who made it with whom, and how they thought about these things. That's what history means. But that's another matter. I mean, the history of spiritual life is not of much concern to such authors, but still, in their book they point out that in Punjab, around the area of Kurukshetra, they have found archaeological evidence from about 3,000 years ago, or maybe 4,000 years ago, that people were living pretty much the same way that Indians live even today. These glass bangles that you see, many thin little tiny glass bangles called churiyan, that many women you see still wearing now. There are shards of those from 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. There are also plates that are shaped the same way that your steel plates are shaped today. Lota, katori, everything the same. For 3,000 or 4,000 years, that's called cultural continuity. What is it that inspires that kind of conservatism? It has to be an understanding of the scientific property of dharma, which we discussed a little bit yesterday, that it's not just a set of imperfect civic codes that we're expected to follow for the purpose of social solidarity. This is what Krishna calls it in Bhagavad Gita, loka sangraha. Loka sangraha mevati, he says. If only for the purpose of social solidarity we are following dharma, that's okay, but that's just a political reality, it's not a scientific or metaphysical one. The fact of the matter is that everyone's swadharma has its basis in the scientific essence of what a person, or what is rather not a person, but a social role is. You may be surprised to learn that the fundamental unit in Vedic society is what? The fundamental social unit in Vedic society is... I'm sorry? we are socialized to assume Kantian's categorical imperatives and other kinds of essentially godless ideologies or philosophies, we don't really think about this. We have the assumption that the individual is the indivisible unit, that the base level unit of the society. That's not true, at least not in a dharmic society. In dharmic society, it's not the individual, it's the social role that he performs. It's not the individual, it's the dharma that he, the obligation, and the also the scientific nature that he has acquired over the process of rebirth in so many different lifetimes. That's a very, very consequential distinction that we need to make, because we will never have a very deep understanding of dharma until we do.
So if you translate social function into Sanskrit, would you say dharmic?
Swadharma.
Swadharma.
Yep. It's not the jivatma who is the fundamental unit of, you know, a family, for example, nor even the, you know, the living entity. It's actually the role that he's expected to fulfill, which corresponds to the svabhava that he has acquired over the course of many births. In other words, as we move, as we transmigrate through material existence in various species of life, we acquire a particular kind of svabhava, and there is a corresponding svadharma, a set of normative duties and obligations that matches that svabhava. That is the fundamental unit of the Vedic society, not the individual and his free will. It's a very, very consequential distinction that must be made. In fact, all over Asian societies, this is a very common phenomenon, in contradistinction to Western societies.
China is actually the formal.
And Japan even more so, I would say. I mean, therefore, you see in Japan, because this concept is retained to some degree, I would say probably through Buddhism, which spread from India to Far East, they brought the concept of dharma with them. I mean, there was one scholar named Aravinda Sharma. He said that with all the cultural, ethnic, linguistic, religious, political diversity of Europe, South Asia never actually fragmented to the same degree that Europe did. Why is that? Because they had this concept of dharma, which was able to allow them to see a unity above and beyond the tremendous variety that still characterizes South Asia, especially.
And it's called Dhammapada.
Yeah, Dhamma. In Pali it would become Dhamma. But this is the idea. So he says this, the concept that was able to allow South Asia to do this, and even now, I mean, it's still there in some degrees because the mindset has already been formulated, it's dharma. Anyway, I don't want to get too far off that topic, but the point is that, we were making is that we have obligations to the demigods. They are, we have obligations to our forefathers as well. And our forefathers, through this understanding, they have made the conscious decision to uphold dharma. In fact, in the Manusmriti, he explains that if one simply treads in the path that one's forefathers have tread, that means forefathers within what they call Aryabhartha, which is everything north of the Vindhya Hills, North India, in the Gangetic Plain, basically, that's what it means. When we follow that civilization, Manu says, and do not deviate from it in any way, then we will never incur sin. Otherwise, it's not. There's no guarantee of anything. Now, so I've mentioned already a few times that it's unfortunate that we've already done this, and it's especially unfortunate here because with this emphasis on the forefathers, we can understand what is the medium through which this dharma is translated from generations to generations. It is transmitted through this social entity and nowhere else. It doesn't exist in the Shastra, except implicitly, because the Shastra says, do what your forefathers are doing. It only exists on a social level, and therefore it must be maintained on a social level, otherwise it will be lost. And we mentioned yesterday, all this wisdom and knowledge and what to speak of our families and all the things that Prabhupada is listing here, and property, intelligence, society, friendship, love, thousands of years of what has been attained in those fields, we can inherit or we can erase within one generation. All it takes. And I've seen it happen in my lifetime in many, many ways. For example, in Mauritius, where my wife comes from, the country is more than 50% Hindu. They were initially brought over there as what they call indentured servants, but basically it was slavery. And they were forced to work in sugarcane fields mainly. Now they're obliged to work in the IT industry and in the tourist industry instead of the self-sufficiency that they have full facilities to develop if they want, and which Srila Prabhupada actually encouraged the leaders of the country to do in the 1970s. But anyway, that's another matter. So in Mauritius, they have retained some aspects of Hindu culture more even than in India. For example, my father-in-law, every morning, like clockwork, or maybe I should say like the sun, every morning he very religiously goes out into the shrine that is placed in front of every single house in Mauritius, for Hanuman mainly, also Tulsi and sometimes other demigods, even Vishnu sometimes. And he offers his lamp there at 6 a.m., every single evening at 6 p.m., if not father-in-law, then at least someone is in the house who will do the same thing. And they've been maintaining this for 200 years, and you know they didn't invent it when they got to Mauritius. It's coming from India. But you don't see this in India anymore. Every house will have a flagpole for Hanuman. And you used to see that in certain places in North India. Maybe still you can find it in Bihar, so I don't know if you look there. Seen, but these things have been maintained in Mauritius, but not in India. So this process has been well underway for at least, 100, 200, 300 years, especially since the British. They really made an impact. After 700 years, the Muslim presence in South Asia did not change India as much as the British after only 200 years. And I'm going to go even further than that and say that within the last 20 years, the presence of the technological, the internet and movies and television and all this sort of media input from Western technology has changed India in the last 20 years more than the British changed in the last 200 years.
And the Muslims in
700 years. Because the Muslims had a commitment to some form of dharma, even though it was Yavana dharma, as the Chaitanya Charitamrita calls it. But they are still a very religious society with some sense of dharma. So were the Buddhists. Everyone in South Asia was dharmic until the British. Then they came along with something else. And even the British in the Victorian era, they had some degree of dharma. But now, America has become so rotten, and other Western countries have become so rotten. Their own culture has been eradicated long ago, whatever culture they had at one point. And so now all they can do is go and infect the rest of the world, figuratively and literally. So it's a carcinogenic. It's a carcinogenic pseudo-culture, and once it's metastasized, there's very little you can do. So it's a very unfortunate situation, and for that reason we find that throughout his books sometimes Srila Prabhupada says, it cannot be revived, it simply cannot. The only hope is this Vaishnava Dharma of Harinam Sankirtana. But at least we should understand these instructions, why we should feel indebted. We need to connect to some degree with the nature that is supporting us. They say that, we mentioned yesterday also, dharma means, it comes from the root, which means to sustain. it's what sustains us. Dharmo rakshati rakshataha. I think that comes from Manu. Somebody who protects his dharma will find that he is protected by that dharma, because dharma is what sustains one in human society. So if we sustain that dharma, and then sustenance again is another word for conservatism, then we will see that this is kept alive. Otherwise, it's very doubtful. So this is our forefathers. We've only got two of these five categories. Prabhupada continues, he says, we are indebted to the general public for politics. Sometimes we don't appreciate politics, but it's a necessary evil. We are indebted to the general public for that. Sociology is another thing. Just think Facebook here, and then you can understand what's going on. And we are also indebted to lower animals, such as horses, cows, asses, dogs, and cats. Especially if you live in Los Angeles, everyone has a chihuahua, it would seem. You really have to watch your step in Los Angeles. They haven't figured out that you just put a bottle of water every 6 feet or so. Do you know this trick? It's guaranteed that if you put a bottle of, like, an empty jug of water every 6 feet on your lawn, you'll have no problems with dogs and cats doing their business there. I don't know why, but it works. In Mauritius, they know that. Anyway, in this way, as soon as one is born in the material world as a human being, he bears so many obligations and is bound to repay them. Now, here's the next thing that's very interesting. If he does not repay them, then he's further entangled in the process of birth and death. And this is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita in the next verse that we've been reading from after text 11 in chapter 3. We get, Ishtan bhogan hibo deva dasyante yakti bhavitaha. Krishna says, in charge of the very necessities of life, the demigods, being satisfied by the performance of yajna or sacrifice, will supply all necessities to you. That we've already described. It's their mercy that they do this. They are, in fact, obligated, especially if one offers them sacrifice, they are obligated. They will fall from their position if they do not reciprocate with the sacrifices that we perform to them. But still, it is voluntary. They don't have to perform their duty if they don't want to. So in charge of the very necessities of life, the demigods who are satisfied by our performance of yajna will supply all necessities. Now, I was raised in Southern California, and I spent many years there recently as well. Every summer in Southern California, they have wildfires that eat up sometimes even half of the state. They just rage out of control, and it takes the entire combined fire brigades of the western United States. They hire or they contract fire departments from as far away as Colorado State in America, just to help California put out these wildfires every year in the summer. They're natural, they've been going on since time immemorial, but they seem to be getting bigger and bigger. And one day I was thinking about this because the fires came very close to my mother's house. The whole sky turned orange. That's a very surreal experience that I don't think you can imagine here. An orange sky, orange brownish sky, and everybody had to wear masks. All over Southern California. And so I was meditating on this. I also know one devotee in the San Diego region who was very wealthy, but he lost his house. He had like 2 seconds to get out of the house. He just had to run out in his underwear in the middle of the night. And then Agni ate up his whole house. Because people are not offering Agni anything to eat, he's going and taking whatever he wants in the form of these wildfires. So that's the first half of the verse, but here's the point. He who enjoys such gifts without offering them to the demigods in return is certainly a thief. This is Krishna. This is Krishna. Krishna is giving his, he's supporting this system. Although, he tells us later on that to worship the demigods for the fulfillment of our material desires is foolish. And he discourages it in that way. But at the same time, it's very clear throughout the Bhagavad Gita that if you have material desires, and if you are maintaining material desires, this is the way to do it. And therefore, for the householder, in whom it's assumed there is some degree of material desire, he has to perform these panchmahayajnas. The only one who's freed from this is also described, again, in Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna says, one who takes pleasure in the self, whose human life is one of self-realization, and who is set aside in the self only, fully satisfied, for him there is no duty. However, a self-realized man has no purpose to fulfill in the discharge of his prescribed duties, nor has he any reason not to perform such work, nor has he any need to depend on any other living being. Therefore, without being attached to the fruits of activities, one should act as a matter of duty, for by working without attachment, one attains the supreme. So although there is one class of person who is very rare, that is the absolutely perfect and self-realized Siddha Purusha, shall we say, especially pure devotees, he doesn't have or she doesn't have any duty to perform. Now the problem is that in Kali Yuga, every one of us assumes that we're all Siddha Purushas. We think we've got no anartha. We don't realize that we depend on other living beings because of the process that we've already described. We're not even in touch with the fundamental laws of material nature enough to see the connections that we have and the interdependencies that we have with other living beings. So this is a grand problem, but even if we are self-realized, Krishna says, we have no reason not to perform such work, but we do have a reason to perform such work. And what is that? I mentioned already. Loka sangraham evati. At least for the purpose of social solidarity. And Krishna says in text 20, karmanayiva hi samsiddhim asthita jinagalayaha loka sangrahamevapi sampashyan karkamarasi. Kings such as Janak attain perfection solely by the performance of prescribed duties. Therefore, just for the sake of educating the people in general, you should perform your work. And then there's another reason he gives in the next verse. Yad acharati shreshtas tatat evetaro janaha sa yat pramanam gurute lokas tat anuvartate. Whatever action a great man performs, common men follow, and whatever standards he sets by exemplary acts, all the world pursues. In other words, if you are perceived as shreshta, the great in any field, people are going to follow whatever you do. And people are going to cite your activities as authoritative reference for their own. That is just a fact of nature. So he said, given that fact, you have to be conscious that you are setting some praman. Sayat pramanam gurute means you're providing someone with evidence for his or her own actions. Therefore, he says, you should act as did the ancients. This is, again, that same conservatism that we noted already that's been characteristic of Vedic culture since time immemorial. We see it again in chapter 4, text number 15, where Krishna says this. Evam gyatva kratam karnama purvayarapi namukshuti guru karnamayiva tasmatvam purvayi purvataram. That means all the liberated souls in ancient times acted with this understanding of my transcendental nature. Therefore, you should perform your duty, following in their footsteps. Purvaihi purvataram kratam. As the ancients, long, long ago, acted, kuru karmaiva tasmatvam. Therefore, you should also act. It's the same thing that we heard from Manu as well. So, that's another thing that's in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, finally, Krishna, or Srila Prabhupada, mentions here that in addition to the obligation issue. Nowadays we don't depend so directly on the animals because we've become fossil fuel based. But still, I mean, they are necessary. They have this function in the material world, and if we attempt to live in harmony with the laws of nature, then we recognize very soon the importance of the animals. So we have to satisfy them. And then, of course, there's all living beings. All living beings means everything from the Paramecium all the way up to Lord Brahma. We have to respect them all because they're all parts and parcels of Vishnu. Then, in the second half of this purport, Srila Prabhupada focuses again on Grihamethi, the person who is overly addicted to enjoying material things. And he doesn't know that simply by taking shelter of Krishna, he becomes freed from all these obligations. Now that means actually really taking shelter of Krishna, fully taking shelter of Krishna. At that stage, we are freed from all the obligations that Varnashram Dharma enjoins upon us. Not until then, and it's important to note that, because evidently we mentioned yesterday, Srila Prabhupada saw that his own disciples had some problems even following the basic principles of Krishna consciousness, and therefore he wanted to establish a little bit more social stability within the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and therefore he was putting more emphasis on this vidhi-based understanding that we're reading about today. So, anyway, this is the Grihamethi is one who is overly addicted to sense gratification, especially sex life, because that's the supreme sense gratification in this material world. So, to the extent that we have any attachment to sex life, or even any kind of material gratification in this world, to that extent we have to regulate it with reference to what the scriptures say. And after describing both the divine and the demoniac natures in chapter 16 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna concludes with much the same principle when he says at the end of chapter 16, when somebody rejects the injunctions of the Shastras and acts instead whimsically according to his whim, he doesn't get any perfection. He doesn't even get happiness. What to speak of the supreme destination. Tasma, therefore, chastram pramanam te karya karya vyavasthitau. You should situate yourself according to the injunctions of the Shastras, and you should discriminate what is to be done and what is not to be done based on what the Shastra says. Not va shastra vidhanoktam, knowing this, the regulations of the Shastra that have been stated since time immemorial, karma kartami arhati, you should do your duty. This is the path towards elevation. Elevation means shreyas. Shreyas means that which may not be instantly pleasing, but is ultimately super excellent, preeminently valuable, and worthwhile. He says, after describing the three gates to hell, which are what? Pretty easy one. He says, achariti atmana shreyas. You should somehow effect the shreyas for yourself. That's the super excellent thing. Tato yati param gatim. Then, in that case, you will go to the supreme destination. And then he details how to do that. It's very clear. You follow what the Shastra says. Otherwise, Prabhupada says, when he's discussing Varnashram Dharma with disciples in one morning walk conversation, he says, the only alternative is that you're going to concoct. And we see that people are concocting so many things. And we have to suffer for that. So, although this is not the woman's intention in today's verse, Srila Prabhupada does spend at least half of his purport discussing the importance of developing this kind of gratitude and following the system that has regularized or normatized this principle of gratitude, also the principle of mercy of superiors, because cannot have any happiness in this world unless you have the blessings of superiors. However, having secured those blessings, one should also understand that this life is very temporary, and although there's a few things that are fun in life, one should not become so distracted that he loses the opportunity that the human form of life has to offer, which is the opportunity for Krishna consciousness. So we'll see what happens in this conversation when Puranjani continues talking to her future husband here. Puranjana. I'll stop here. If anybody have any questions or comments, we can discuss. If then he will be, he may be free, if Krishna desires, from the reactions of not having repaid that debt. If Krishna desires, and we don't really ever know, I mean, at least we can't objectively demonstrate this sort of thing. So, there's two things here. Number one is the rarity of a person actually surrendering to that degree. And then the second thing is that, you know, whether Krishna's unfettered will is to absolve the person of responsibility for whatever any karmic reaction he's had. This is a very interesting point. We know from the Brahma Samhita, karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajam, that when one participates in bhakti, then his karmas are burnt up. But it's not always that all the karmas are burnt up. Sometimes only some of the karma is burnt up, and sometimes some of the karma remains. Because, I mean, that's also stated in the same verse, and in other verses as well. So, you know, whether it's Krishna or whether it's our karma functioning in any given time, place, and circumstance, it's very difficult to say with certainty in an objective manner, and so we have to be a little bit cautious about that. But, the Srimad Bhagavatam puts it very well in the 11th canto, or maybe it's the 12th canto, I don't remember, but there's one verse that says that as long as one has not become fully satiated in Krishna consciousness and awakened a constant taste, an ever-deepening taste in Krishna Katha, then that person has to very carefully mold his life in such a way that he's working within the boundaries of, within the grammatical framework which is outlined in the Vedic Shastras for you know, the way that we organize our eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, basically. Whatever degree of Pravritti Marga we're on, it has to be governed by the Shastras that are in place for that process. That's my understanding. And it's interesting when you get to Vaishnavism, because of this principle that I just mentioned, where it's never entirely clear as to whether we're, you know, being supported by Krishna or whether we're running on our own karma or not. Therefore, we see historically in Vaishnava Sampradayas, it's a little bit of a, you know, there's some. Sometimes there's a little bit more emphasis put on the Shastra Vidhan, as Krishna is mentioning in chapter 16, and sometimes it's a little less. It depends on the amount that we assume that we're on that transcendental platform. So that's a fluctuating socio-political and historical reality. Okay. Is it making sense?
Yeah.
I mean, in Gaudiya Math, for example, many of the disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they were coming from smart Brahmin families. And so it was a big controversy in the Gaudiya Math. What do we do about this? Because, you know, we have our social life, with the grihasthas in particular, we have our obligations to our parents and to our class and to, you know, in India especially, that at that time, nearly 100 years ago now, it was much more conservative than it is now. And people actually had a sense of obligation to these things, and so it was a real problem. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had to work it out as to how his disciples would deal with that. If we are trying to understand how to apply Prabhupada's instructions in Varnashram, then those records, which are now being very carefully collected by devotees such as Hari Shari Prabhu, the records of all of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's writings, even those of his father Bhaktivinod, they're all being archived in manuscripts in Kolkata Research, Bhaktivedanta Research Center in Kolkata. It's a very, very wonderful project headed up by Harishori Prabhu, who has the foresight to realize the importance of that task. So that's a wonderful resource that we have to really understand how these things are going to apply to us. And if we're serious about following Srila Prabhupada's instructions about Varnashram, we need to know that sort of thing. So, I don't know, that's kind of a long answer to your question. Is that okay? you know, there's a similar, I mean, this is an eternal problem, you know, that the struggle between the asuras and the suras is the struggle between dharma and adharma. And it's always a problem in this material world. There's always, you know, as I said, that people are trying to juxtaposition their two attachments, because as conditioned souls, we have demoniac attachments, and then we also have some divine tendencies as well. And the Vedic literature is meant to standardize behavior in human society, because it's understood that people have greater or lesser degrees of such material attachment. But if we don't recognize that, and if we don't recognize the scientific basis of that standardization process, then we're not really going to be able to derive much benefit.
And my other comment was about the interconnectivity of everything. I think our modern culture doesn't recognize that we need the animals. We think that they're troublesome, especially in North America, Europe. But basically, there's a way to engage every creature.
Yeah.
But even amongst the devotees, when they forbid usage and don't apply these things, especially in our diets and habits.
Yeah, that's all implicit in the Bhutanam principle. Around 100 years ago, when the Indian independence movement was struggling to get off its feet, in Hindi literature, which I've studied, there was a big controversy that, are we going to emphasize in our writings — these are literary people — are we going to emphasize the ideal of social obligation based on appreciation for the value of the humanizing properties of an agrarian culture, such as we traditionally have in India? Many, many people who appreciated that legacy in India at that time. And then on the other hand, there were the forward-looking ones — we call it forward-looking — those who were following Jawaharlal Nehru and others who were mostly aimed at westernizing and industrializing and modernizing and whatever else you want to call that. So there was a kind of a, you know, there was a tug of war between them about that. I mean, it's always like that. We always have to, if we cultivate within our intelligence a mature understanding and assimilation of the scientific properties of dharma, I think, then we will see that there's not a great deal of difference between ecology and dharma, because both of them have the same effect. Especially what they call deep ecology. Deep ecology means, you know, the fundamental principles of, you know, almost, you know, it takes on almost religious dimensions of obligation that one should feel towards the preservation of the environment in general.
Like the concept of Gaia.
Exactly. Exactly.
The spirituality is completely linked.
There's a relatively new field in Western universities called religious ecology or ecological religious studies, in which it's recognized that, particularly in South Asia, you know, if you want to find a policy that will drive the process of ecological activism, what we call it, you know, environmental activism in the Western countries, the ideology is already in place in the form of dharma. And, you know, people still in India have enough commitment, enough understanding of, and therefore appreciation for, the principles of dharma, that if the struggle, say, to prevent dams, new dams from being built, because they cause so much damage, you know, if somebody wants to stop one of those, then it's understood that the effort has to be expressed in terms that are religious rather than socio-political. In the Western world, it's the opposite. If you bring in religion, you're dead in the water. You know. There's a very nice book was written on the plight of the Yamuna River, a dying goddess, so to speak, by Dr. David Haberman of the University of Indiana. He He's also a kind of devotee, but not ISKCON, but very, very, very much favorable practitioner of bhakti in its various forms. So he's written a very nice book on the Yamuna, and he's discussed these things at length and with all detail. Recently out, it's called River of Love. Don't forget who published it, but you can look it up. Okay, anything else? Yeah, one more, please.
Just remind you.